Yeah, I just have a few housekeeping chores, and I'm going to zip through these because I know why you came. You didn't come to listen to me. You come to listen to them. You've been given a card with a pencil. Write any question that you have for these individuals on that. About halfway through, we'll collect them. And then they're going to be sorted in groups so we can create some themes for those questions. I'm sorry we aren't able to have an open mic, but we just don't have the time to do that. At a book signing, please be kind of polite in the lines and with the number of books that you're going to have signed. We hope that is organized, and we expect you to act like Spartans, or maybe not.
Two.
Yeah. Okay. Before I begin, I just want to tell you that I really did have a help from a lot of friends in putting together some questions. I asked through email a number of people if they could ask each author the same question, what would it be? And I have incorporated some of those questions into tonight's conversation. I wanted to do that for full disclosure so you didn't think I was cheating. Now let's get into what the late author Norman Mailer called the spooky art. Hemingway has often been quoted as saying something like, he wouldn't want to go to a heaven that didn't accept dogs. As authors, the three of you weave those wonderful and often frustrating creatures into your writing. You've got a short story called Puppy, and I'm not going to give away any of these stories because some of them are pretty unique in their endings. In Keep the Change, you write about a dying dog, Tom. In a recent interview, Tom talked about the insignificance of man in terms of dogs. He said, I find it more consoling to think of myself as a little than to think of myself as a big. I think I've gotten that from animals, particularly dogs. Dogs live such a modest life, and they don't live long. And the more you're around them, you kind of accept that. Jim Harrison probably took it to the ultimate level. Not only did he dedicate his first book to his best friend, Tom McGuain, but also to his dog. Jim, why don't you start?
Who was first?
Tell us about how you've used dogs in your writing and what they mean to you personally.
Well, I just think I was confused when I was young. And still am. I asked my dad the difference between animals and us, and he said, well, they live outside and we live inside. So I always thought of them as fellow creatures. So I don't differentiate. And in my own sort of private beleaguered religion, it's difficult, totally impossible to think that I'm more important than my dogs, period.
No. Richard, you take it next. I know you... You use them as a vehicle to carry a lot of your stories forward. So,
yeah, dogs, you know, are like putting dogs in stories, or like putting children in stories. It allows for the principles in the story to relate to them. I mean, I'm giving you a serious answer. I beg
That's
your
great.
Pardon. But you're always looking for something to dangle in a story that will cause the people that you're really mostly interested in to respond in some kind of way. And dogs usually bring out, well, in some people anyway, bring out the good in people, the sympathetic in people. And because like you said before, they, or like Tom said, you know they're going to die, so you have an innate sympathy for them. And it also establishes your dominion over that, too.
Tom, I know you have got a lot of dog stories.
Yes. Well, I've had a lot of dogs. When I turned 60, somebody asked me how I felt about it, and I said, oh, I'm delighted. I don't have to outlive that many more dogs. I live out in the sticks with a lot of dogs and horses, and the horses are these creatures that sort of live in a state of benign innocence, and dogs are kind of lawyers. And I always wondered, really, the great thing about being around animals is, if you love them or are interested in them, you're trying to see how they see the world. It's one of the one of the few opportunities we really get at, you know, the post-LSD era for consciousness expanding. And but one of the, I finally figured out that dogs really have us about right. And I read a fact that if you abandon your home and your dogs, within 3 months they'll begin denning. They sort of know it's a sort of a tentative relationship they have with us. We pour love on them and let them sleep in bed with us and feed them all the time. But they have, I think, a very appropriate suspicion of the human race. And that's why I think when you have dogs, you always feel, to some degree, you're sort of auditioning for them.
I liked that last part because I thought that I got a new Scottish Lab a couple of years ago. And I saw her, because they tend to be high IQ dogs, struggling to learn my language, and I struggling to learn her essentially verbless language. And she resembled so much my new grandson, who doesn't use verbs.
Lucky it's not a granddaughter.
Yeah, who doesn't use verbs either, because, hey, what are they about me? Now, here, you know. And sometimes I think we lose the respect because of our failures to learn their language. I've noticed that when hunting.
It is kind of an interesting thing. We all hunt. We've had bird dogs, and we hunt with our friends. And every now and then you have that moment where you realize your friend's dog has lost all respect for your friend.
Could you tell us a particular story about one of your friends?
Well, we have a mutual friend, Guy Valdin, a wonderful guy who loves dogs. He's the worst dog handler I've ever seen. And usually what you see with Guy is his face is inflated to double size. He has a little Acme whistle between his lips, and his dog has given him a Horizon job.
And they're little horrible little French Britneys,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, right. And you get the feeling that, you know, you hope with all your heart that the dog is not onto something.
Okay, we're going to move on to a topic that's a lot more
we
serious.
You like the dog deal? That's our sort of mental level.
No. Oh, you're going to like this one.
We
better.
Can stay right here, actually. Yeah.
No need to move on.
Actually, I suggested that we put a dog on stage, but somewhere along the line it got nixed. I couldn't imagine why.
Lie right there.
Yeah, right here. It's perfect for a dog. Okay, this is one of the questions I definitely borrowed from author Lisa Litzenberger, who's a good friend of yours, Jim. She could not be here tonight, but she said she wants to ask about this. She says, doesn't all your writing boil down to love stories? Above all the swagger and testosterone, you really are writing love stories, she said. Lisa believes that this gets overlooked. She says it's vanishing from our world. There's so much irony and a belief that nothing much matters anymore. And I think that that's a question that a lot of you might want to ask about. And let's go. Let's start with Tom.
Well, that's a very strong suggestion, and it's true, I think. Chekhov thought that all stories were really love stories. And I think that the degree of its importance to us as writers is how difficult it is to face it. You know, it's the most powerful thing there is. It's the most difficult thing to write about. It's the thing that you can look most foolish writing about if you don't get it right. It's the biggest challenge. And sometimes it's just a lot easier about going hunting with your dog.
Yeah, there's something about that, because I thought I'd give it a relatively simple man in the Upper Peninsula who turned out, I've known him, I should have known better, it's not simple, that 12 volumes of Chekhov's stories. And he says, I really liked those stories once I could get the names right, but I was all the time sobbing. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. Isn't that such an appropriate response? I don't know why Lisa would ask that, because it's, well, yeah, in her novels. But the primary fact about, say, an early novella of mine, Legends of the Fall, is not people shooting each other. It's the love that he and two heroines had for each other, I think.
It's kind of fun to pour a little lead into them, though, to just keep you up.
Yeah.
Yeah, too.
Keep the audience.
The woman, too, with the little red dime in her forehead.
Well, yeah, I was thinking about something Mavis Gallant said to me one time. She said, you know, if we knew what went on between women and men, we wouldn't need literature.
Fabulous.
And in a way, I mean, when you first said that, I thought, well, why does everything have to be when you boil this down?
Yeah.
Because the thing that we're, you know, trying all the time not to do is boil everything down.
Don't you know that song, Boil Them Cabbages Down?
Well, we're trying to put into books all of the things that we know that are interesting.
Yeah.
And so then to start kind of turning the fire up on it so that it comes down to some distillate, kind of in a way defeats some of the pleasures.
Richard, remember that incredible story you had years ago in the New Yorker, because I had the same experience that my wife is the boy in love with his aunt.
Right.
It was utterly overwhelming because the purity of a 12-year-old boy in love with his aunt is just filthy. Simply overwhelming. Right.
But you wouldn't, you wouldn't necessarily see it if it weren't in the story.
Yeah.
You wouldn't necessarily see it as that. You wouldn't see it as that he was in love with her, but that the story frames it in that way.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Henry James said, I think, something that you really can't get around, which is literature really only has one obligation, and that is to be interesting.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be well-formed.
No.
It doesn't have to be about anything in particular.
And it can be really too long.
It can be too long. But it really... I think in the way, in many ways, our generation of literary fictioneers have failed people is that we've written a lot of too much technically accomplished stuff that really wasn't interesting.
Right.
Yeah, true.
Right. And the other thing is, you know, the reason why stories might be about love fundamentally is that what two people do in a room together, which is where love, I said, what is this? If that is for me, would you tell them that I am busy? But what two people do in a room where they are alone together is a real little laboratory for morality, in a sense, because that's where you can you can really concentrate on what's right and what's wrong and who's lying and who's not.
Who's well-dressed?
Who's well-dressed?
Sometimes who's undressed? I've read your books.
You know, though, the trouble with that a little bit, I remember reading when I was 19 and very impressionable, unlike now, that Lorca said there are only these three subjects to write about: love, suffering, and death. And then I have a tendency toward the lacrimose anyway, so Lorca then in a later line said, I'm neither all man or all poet. I'm only the pulse of a wound that probes to the opposite side. This wasn't cheering me up. What I'm saying, maybe I'll read Das Passos about actual people living out their lives, you know?
Well, there's a sort of subtle kind of membrane between actual people or journalism or reports and what we try to do. It's amazing that you can read a lot of actual stuff about actual people and not find anything interesting about it.
Absolutely.
And that's the kind of the mystery, I think, of literature is that odd kind of little ski course down through reality that kind of ends up producing a reality that's much more intense than what passes for facts.
Because it's closer to the truth.
Yeah, truth, I guess.
But you said in a recent letter, there's this Tolstoy letter, but sort of, I guess, a nobleman loves this girl so much, he shoots her because it's getting tiresome.
Well, not so much tiresome as unbearable. I mean, he's so madly in love with her, the pain is so exquisite, the only thing that he can think of to do is to shoot her.
Yeah.
This happens every day in Detroit.
Very Albanian.
Well, one of the questions I know a lot of you are wondering, and all I ask is, when did each of you realize that you really loved words and wanted to be a writer, and what contributed to that? Was it your parents, your teachers, reading, schools? Tom, you go first on this one.
I actually remember the little epiphany, and it's not going to move anybody to change their thinking about anything, but we had all sorts of books around our house, and I was home alone, and I was a little kid, and I picked up Alice in Wonderland. And for some reason, I read the opening 20 or 30 words, whatever they were, that kind of fabulous, almost Joycean stuff that opens Alice in Wonderland. And I remember almost feeling that I'd been struck by lightning. I mean, it was, and I can't account for this. I don't have a good explanation. In fact, I've never told anybody this before. In fact, you know, as a kind of a macho pig, I didn't want to be associated with Alice in Wonderland.
Jim's starting to cry.
Yeah. Well, then she went down in that, remember? That whole,
yeah. Yeah, that was better. But yeah. So that's an honest answer to that. That's when it really began for me.
Richard, when did...
Everything, you know, is for me in retrospect. I didn't know anything at the time it was happening to me when I was young. But I have come to think that growing up in Mississippi in a racially divided society in which everything did not mean what it was said to mean. In which language was often just turned on top of itself, made us little students of language in a way, because you were constantly being told something that didn't bear out. You were being told that in church, for instance, that God created all men equal. But I'm sorry, you can't go to school with these people over here, and you can't play athletics with these people over here. So it had, as we all know, it had its whole lexicon, and which is to say the lexicon of racism, and it made me, and not just myself, but it made me and all of my friends little students of the absurdity that was in language, how language could mean one thing and actually not be what it meant. And so I think it was at that point that language became interesting to me.
God, that's interesting.
I had two things that I hadn't quite thought about until Tom said what he said, which he just said about Lewis Carroll, because I remember in perpetually hormonal frenzy of being 14, I kept falling in love with dumb girls, and I was already reading good fiction at the time. I thought, gee, couldn't they improve their lines? Maybe I should write. Okay. But then I was reading John Keats, and who really struck me then because of the clarity of Keats's language. I loathed Shelley, and I thought, well, why do I like Keats? Well, he's a better writer. You know, he's a much, you know, the poetry of birth is never dead. Shelley couldn't say such a thing. And then what I just thought when Tom talked about Lewis Carroll, a farmer friend of my dad committed suicide, and this is hitting me now, probably because I'm here where my dad taught ag for a while. I said, a friend of my dad's committed suicide, and I said, I was about 14, to my dad, did he leave a note? And he said, no, he wasn't good at language. You know, and I'm thinking, wow, how the horror of that man doing that. But he had four kids or something, an unsuccessful farmer up in Osceola County. Here he's hanging himself from in the barn, and he doesn't have enough language to write a note to explain what he's done. And so I thought, because I spent a youth being semi-suicidal, so at least I'm going to get the language. You know, it's that absurd.
I had a kind of a moment like that, and you're reminding me of it. And I bet Richard has one too, about how you first discover you can make something happen with language. You know, my family were all Milltown, New England, Irish Catholics, kind of. Just above slum level, lived in the triple deckers, which were pretty happy places where everybody told stories. And I had one uncle who said, you must never leave a room unless everybody's laughing. And until they are, you really can't leave the room. But my grandfather died, and my grandmother went to bed, and she was a great force in our lives. She was a little tiny woman who really kind of micromanaged all the rest of the family. She was an Irish immigrant who had been a maid in a wealthy Yankee household, and lived to see her son graduated first from the Harvard Law School, go on to the Massachusetts Bar Association, be a judge. She had all the excitement of being a new American. But anyway, she was a force, and she went to bed. And it was so shocking to everybody, she just stopped like a clock. And people really didn't know what to do about it in this tall household. So she liked me a lot. So they said, Tommy, you've got to go upstairs and talk to Grandma. And so I had it in my mind that my grandfather, who had worked as a ship's chandler and probably thought he must have known some pirates. And so I was brooding about this and going on this unpleasant assignment to see my grandmother. And I went up, and she was in bed, and she'd been there for 2 weeks. She was with her head in the pillow, head just expressionless. And I sat by her bed for about 10 minutes. I tried to think of something to say. And finally I said, did Grandpa leave me any jewels? And she stared at me and started laughing. Threw the covers off, got out of bed, and the house started to run again.
It was a miracle.
It was a miracle.
You know, that's a very interesting story because it says something about two people talking to each other. And if you think that literature actually does, as Shakespeare thought it did in a way, resemble speech. I mean, that's what the meter of Shakespeare and literature has as its common denominator. It sounds like speech. We don't ask very much as human beings from conversation. Most of the conversation that takes place between people is just I talk and then you talk and then I talk and maybe I don't listen and then you talk, and mostly it's about yourself. But literature really is another kind of conversation. Yeah. And indeed, when I was growing up in Mississippi, albeit with all of this absurdity going around, conversation was always a way that one person entertained some other person. When you talk to another person, you really were trying to get them to laugh, or trying to get them mostly to laugh, but to pay attention, or to be shocked, or to be surprised in a way. And then that person would return the favor to you. And in a way, that was, for me, you said maybe I had a similar experience. And I do have a similar experience.
Well, what you're saying is so intriguing, because I thought now punditry thinks that talking is thinking.
Yes.
But you hear it all the time. But in literature, talking is thinking.
Yes.
It's a way to express thoughts. Because I had this awful time. My Swedish immigrant grandfather had been out to South Dakota before Wounded Knee. He was about 15. He wanted to be a cowboy. And this seems so extraordinary. But the only person he would talk to about this was my sister, who then consequently died at age 19. Mm. She was the only one, for some reason, like your grandma knew, that he would talk to about this.
Because being probably he got something back from it.
There was some incredible response there.
Yeah.
You know, like that early story of the great novelist Knut Hampson. Supposedly had TB, was going to die. But it's typical Scandinavian fashion. He wrote from Rapid City to New York, sitting on top of a train with his mouth open, and it cleansed his lungs, and consequently he loved to become a Nazi and a very good novelist.
Well, you know, Hampson stayed in Minneapolis for a while. Here's the power of speech that I like. He knew he had tuberculosis. He hadn't set out on his train journey. And he was staying with a Lutheran minister and his beautiful young wife. And he came up with this scheme, which was to take the young wife aside and say, I will be dead soon. And I wonder if you would lend me a bit of money to go to a house of ill repute. And she said, on thought, I can take care of you myself.
Is that my thought? Yeah, but this is the man who began a novel called Hunger. I was starving in an attic 3 feet from the moon, which is a great sentence.
I think any of you that have read these three gentlemen understand that their books are, in actuality, filled with some of this humor. There's a tremendous sense of irony, and the absurd lingers on every page sometimes. But the one of the winners, I think all-time winners of this this sort of strange humor is a piece, Jim, that you contributed to a collection on fishing for your friend Russell Chatham. It was titled Ice Fishing, the Moronic Sport. Now, some of you here might take some.
He got death threats.
That was under his tutelage. Tom loaned me a book that changed my life. I don't know, we were in our 20s. Flann O'Brien.
Oh, yes.
And I'm still writing pieces for Michael Ondaatje's magazine that comes out of Toronto, Brick. Yeah. And I go up to Toronto where there are more real literate people. They all say to me, you read Flann O'Brien?
Yeah.
And then I said, yeah, McGuane sent it to me a long time.
Richard, in Rock Springs, one of the classic lines, at least for me, your character Marge says to Sims, how would you hate to die most? He answers, I'd hate to be bored to death. That was, to me, that was like pretty good piece.
I just wrote a line I'm very proud of. I wrote it today, and it's a little bit in that genre. I have a character in this novel I'm working on who's an emergency room doctor, and he has to go through an AIDS protocol with a guy because of his injury he had. And finally he gets the sense that this person that he's talking to, and it's pertinent information, is gay. So the doctor builds up his courage to ask him. He said, are you gay? And the guy looks at him and chuckles a little bit, and he said, of course I'm gay. What else is there to do in this town?
You're going to get death threats.
Yeah, I know.
You're going to get death threats.
Let me take it back. He was a gay ice fisherman.
You've been to Bay City. It's my hometown, so you know.
No, I got Sports Illustrated. It was a lie, and it was such fun to write. I was writing about fly fishing for saltwater species in Key West, and I said, not oddly, there's the Gay Anglers Alliance down here. Gay fly fisherman, and they accepted it, and then later they felt betrayed. But I can't write straight nonfiction because I don't believe. I think everything is fiction, frankly.
Well, I'm going to shut up here in a minute, but I do have to interject one thing. Is Frank O'Connor was asked about the relationship between journalism and literature. And he said, much of fiction is really journalism. And he said, but in the case of a great writer like Chekhov, it's 99% journalism. That's a kind of a challenging remark, but there is something to that. I mean, if you look at sort of the best of Updike, I mean, it's just perilously close to some sort of photorealistic journalism, not to its deficiency either.
Do you mean by that that you think that if when he writes about something that he did it?
You mean in O'Connor's?
No, just Updike when he writes about.
I sometimes wonder. In the last of the Rabbit books, I happened to have seen him when he was doing that, and he had taken this long drive down to Florida, and he wrote this fabulous passage about what he called Rama Land. I think it was called Spinorama, Movie-O-Rama, all this. And he had this thing that went on and on about Rama Land, Rama World, and I realized that it was very close to almost Wolfian journalism, you know. I don't think things are worked up in that manner.
I think you're right in the extent that it's fun to read Dostoevsky's notebooks because you see how much of his fiction was sort of veiled journalism because he would get obsessed about a news item. He thought he'd found a new theme, and European literature, this is like 1868, because a girl in St. Petersburg had committed suicide and left a note saying she had committed suicide because she was bored. Mm. He said, this is a new theme in European literature. The idea that, but how much he depended.
Right. Even Dostoevsky.
Right. Yeah, on what you're saying,
I think the fact that your work is so deeply embedded in our world is greatly to its credit. And and I can say as a writer that it looks like a tremendous amount of hard work. And I think the reader is well served by it.
And it's I never really thought about that before, but I think it's true that when I don't like something, or I read a piece of fiction and I think to myself, there's something that really defective about this, what I always say about it is, this is just made up stuff.
Yeah, it's not thingy.
Yeah.
It's not thingy. Nothing, no details are observed. There's no observation of the attenuations of actual emotions people could have. You know that marvelous story you have that I was horrified when they're going over toward Dillon or something to make a real estate deal. This man is so brilliant. At the end of the day, he's right, but absolutely everybody hates him.
Yeah, right.
You know, for obvious reasons. Yeah.
Well, that's the Gallatin story. That's the story I wrote you about.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that you've really kind of broached here, and it's a great lead-in, is if you go to the archives where these collections of their work is, you can see their research that goes in. It's extensive. It's amazing to look from an idea on a single sheet of paper that ultimately becomes a Pulitzer Prize, for example. But the research is often overlooked because you just get to read the novel. But you don't see the hours, the weeks, the years that you gentlemen put into this. It's taken tremendously for granted. And I know you say you take a year off to think.
Thoreau said that a writer is a man who, having nothing to do, finds something to do.
I learned that problem.
case in point.
No, I learned that from Tom in my 20s, because I noticed in his fiction there's a curious attention to detail that I didn't really have, you know, in the sporting club in early. And I said, maybe I should pay more attention. But then I started, what's dangerous is research can be a thing in itself. Like before I wrote Dolph, I made like 8 trips to Nebraska Historical Society. And the night before strip club, for obvious reason. Like night after night of suffering. And I thought, I said, this
strip
research
club
is getting out of hand.
I was up steelhead fishing last year with a guy who lives up in northern British Columbia, and he's a classical guitarist, and he teaches in the local school. And we were fishing, and we're getting bored, and we're getting hungry. I said, let's get something to eat. And he said, I've got an idea. He said, let's go. I know a place where we can watch the peelers. That's what they call strippers in Canada. We'll go up and watch the peelers, and we'll get a hamburger. I said, fine. So we walk into this kind of lager bar, and it was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and there's really nobody in there. And my friend's name is David Brown, and we ordered a couple of beers and some cheeseburgers and stuff, and we're eating them. The curtain opens up and to this empty room, and here is this beautiful girl, really not wearing any clothes. And she's dancing around, and it's kind of awkward because you want to hide with your fellow voyeurs, and you can't. So after a while, she started kind of peering out over the lights, trying to figure out what kind of nuts are in there at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And she came out of off the stage and walked straight toward us, stark naked, and she says, Mr. Brown, what are you doing in here? It was one of his students.
Lovely.
Well, you can see from that, Bill, that But we don't look like three people who've worked hard all of our lives.
this research is really tough stuff, isn't it?
Well, no, aimless driving around and looking things over. That's the most fun you're going to have.
Absolutely.
Checking things out. Because people don't know. I've told the story over and over again. They didn't think it was true. They said, where did you get that incredible title for Legends of Fall? I said, McGuane gave it to me one afternoon. Why don't you call it Legends of the Fall? So I did. And the other one, Richard Brodigan, who was obviously a nutcase terminal alcoholic, but he was a good friend, and he loaned me the money to finish writing Farmer, an early novel. And I couldn't find a title. And he says, I charge a quarter for titles. You know? And I said, okay, I put out 50 cents. And he says, what's it about? And I said, it's about a farmer. And he said, give me a quarter. Then he said, farmer. This is the elegance of art.
Publishers must really love you guys.
Who cares?
Yeah. Jim, you mentioned this sort of aimless driving around, but one of the similarities in all of your writing really is that sort of still the great American road trip. You got to get in your car and drive somewhere. It's been a staple of our literature in this country forever, and it goes back to Greek literature. And you,
it does?
Yeah, I think it does.
Odysseus, he wandered around.
Or Odysseus, sorry, yeah.
Odysseus,
yeah, I know. It's a road novel.
Yeah. That was actually, it was a love story. But I think all your novels, that they have this essential restlessness of your characters. They're always kind of fidgeting in a literary way. And I know, Jim, you hitchhiked across America several times. Just this past spring, you drove another 1,700 miles to come back to the UP. I know you've been on some legendary, like, 10,000-mile trips. Richard, you've moved 14 times, haven't you? Something like that I read?
Yes.
You're restless. That qualifies. And Tom told me that even though his daughter now says, the dad, you got to go further than the mailbox. I mean, you drive each weekend probably 700 miles one way for a rodeo. Mm-hmm, so, true. I mean, you're still doing it.
I do hate it, though, I must say.
He keeps doing it. He's doing this for 20 years.
Yeah, he loves to hate. So do you... do you think about that when you start out, or is it just what the characters do? They get and go somewhere. You went on your Hall of Fame trip, which was a legendary trip.
Right, I did do that. Well, that's just because I didn't want to get any of the details wrong. I think that there's something about people arriving in some place that's foreign to them and accommodating or acclimating themselves to some place where they've never been that is fundamentally dramatic. And in the process of doing that, you can reveal or you can talk about the processes that go about acclimating yourself. And in a way, we all do that to ourselves, whether we go from place to place or whether we go from relationship to relationship or whatever we go to. We're always doing that.
But
we're
don't all, you like it because it makes you more vulnerable? So oddly enough, you're like,
yes.
I hate book tours, but then I get in the Ajax Diner in Oxford.
Absolutely.
And I think, gosh, I'm really enjoying myself.
Yeah.
You know, people know about books and you're sort of oddly happy.
Sure.
You know,
well,
yeah.
There was a study done once that people who move to a new town, something like 90% of what they ever learn about the town, they learn in about 3 weeks.
About 3 weeks.
And then they just plateau out and shut it down.
Ha, interesting.
I mean, that's kind of the story of American literature. I mean, Americans have a kind of, in their mind, they have a European model, which is that we are all brought up in a place and we stay there. But in fact, we're apt to move in America. Just the history of America is about that kind of westward migration. Today we're talking about white people, of course. But in the schism between the model that we have in our brains and what we actually habitually, intuitively do is, again, the stuff of the stuff of conflict is the stuff of drama.
I remember Cheever saying that he thought that man made a better traveler than a farmer. And I think there's a lot to that.
Question. There's a historical basis. The farming thing came way after.
Way late. And also where agricultural communities coexist with hunting communities, then the hunting communities are generally gentler people.
Always. Nomads are the politest
people. I live around
some
really mean Norwegian farmers, so I endorse them.
No, they're assholes. No, nomads are the politest people in the world. They have to be, or they get beaten up or something. They're us more polite. Once we settle down into these little hideous nativist crannies, that's when we really got rotten.
Paul Bowles would make you think that they weren't the kindest people in the world.
What's kind? You know, so you get buggered once in a while. You can't get over it.
Not very soon. Well,
I told you you'd have a good time.
There's a wonderful sort of oral history kind of style cowboy memoir called We Pointed Them North. It's a kind of classic of Western literature. It's just a semi-literate man named Teddy Abbott who recorded his life going up and down the trail driving cattle from Texas to Montana. And he said, he lived well into the 20th century, and in fact his granddaughter once worked for me. And she was very superstitious about him. She said, you know, we take a bottle of whiskey up to, he was called Blue, we take a bottle of whiskey up to Teddy Blue's grave every New Year's Eve, and he's a ghost, she said. And I said, how do you know that? She said, because we come back the next day, the whiskey's always gone. but anyway, he said, contrary to the mythology of Western movies, he said most cowboy bars, Western or drover bars, were quite quiet, polite places. And he said it may have been because everyone had a gun. But he said there weren't rowdy places where people walked all over each other. People had a very good sense of their boundaries in those kinds of wandering societies like that one was.
Well, etiquette, this is so odd because when I researched loggers, generally speaking, they had a very high range of etiquette because the fight could often be fatal. You know, they have these hobnail boots, and they would jump up and down on each other. Nobody wanted this. Right. So they really tended to be high-minded, relatively peaceful people. You know?
One of the things I noticed...
Compared to Republicans.
Well, you know, if you go out into flyover country... And go into a bar, as opposed to going to a bar in New York. People in New York in bars will say the most god-awful things to each other. The most phenomenally insulting things that would have semi-lethal consequences if you try it in Missouri. It's almost as though language in those situations has been totally devalued.
True.
I remember sitting in a bar, actually, in Montana, when one guy mouthed off and he said, how would you like me to kick your ass? And the other guy kind of thought about it, and he drank for a minute, and he said, I think I'll hold off.
True. That's the diminution of language. You know, Bob, my ex-agent, Bob D'Attilio, Sicilian, sort of moved from Paris because he got in a fight with a Arab, because the Arab was kicking his dog to death, and Bob jumped over a car hood. They got a really near fatal fight. And then the Arab said, I'm going to kill you. And so Bob took that seriously, because it's Cecilia. So I went to Eric, who's the largest homicide detective in France. He's about 6'10", and about 500 pounds. And Eric says, tell your friend that in this neighborhood, Arabs tell somebody they're going to kill somebody else every day, two or three times. It means that it's not Sicily. In other words, you gotta reevaluate the language. Yeah. Meanwhile, Bob has sold his apartment in Paris because he's taking the guy seriously.
It's like Arnold Stang saying, I'm going to kill you a million times.
One of the things that I noticed also when I was going through the archives is You guys are really working writers. And I don't mean that you're not working when you're writing your novels, but you write for everything. It's kind of amazing. I think that's sort of maybe a dying way of writing, but you can go through, and I picked up this book on, it was titled Road Trips, Head Trips, and Other Car-Crazed Writings. Looked pretty interesting. I pick it up, there's a poem by Jim, and a short story. The short story was Log of the Earth Toy Drumfeater. I mean, you've written, Richard, for conceivably every magazine, I think, that's out there, and you do it well. You know their style. Just a few weeks ago, you had a piece in the Wall Street Journal about summer living, where you live. Tom, you've written for anything that's outdoor, from what I can tell. I mean, that's been your life, is writing.
It's a living.
And we didn't,
well,
and we didn't want to.
Part of it, if someone in the old days, I remember, Ben's Journal's time, wanted me to think of going to Iraq, and I said, I wouldn't go to Iraq for $15,000. And they said, okay. And I said, no. I'm still not going to Iraq. But if they're paying the tab, you start to think, I got a couple daughters, grandchildren, and they need cars. Redecorate, redo their homes, all this stuff. Why not do it? You know, but not, that didn't include Iraq.
I got a great lesson in making a living from my youngest daughter Annie, who was in daycare in Livingston, Montana, and they had a typewriter in there. And Ann was, I think, 5 or 6 years old. She was banging away on the typewriter. And the teacher came up and said, Annie, do you like to play on the typewriter? And Annie said, yes, I do. And the teacher said, does your dad like to play on the typewriter? And she said, yes, he does. And she says, is he always going to do that? She said, he'd better, or we're going to lose that ranch.
That's great. That's fabulous. Yeah, because I used to complain, we're not doing much. Jesus, this year I had to go to Russia and Africa and South America, and then I realized I'm in a country tavern where nobody gets to go anywhere, and I'm whining about my wretched life.
Oh, yeah.
Having to go to these foreign countries.
Well, if you're going to be a writer in America, you've got few choices. That's about right. How to make a living.
Yeah.
And one choice.
If you don't want to teach.
If you don't want, that's it. If teachers, you don't want to teach, and I didn't want to teach because I thought I have to work much too hard. And I make too little money. And I didn't like to be around 19-year-olds all my life. And I just simply thought, this is just not for me. Because, I know we're at a university, and so, and there are probably some people who teach, who are in this audience. But I just thought, you have to be in one place all the time.
Yeah, the horror.
And you're the only one aging. They're always the same.
They're always 19.
What did you say?
I said, you're the only one aging.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And there are all these beautiful girls, and you can't touch them. You go right into the slam, as soon as you do that. I thought, that's just...
And they beat you up.
It's just a horrible experience in that way. So I thought, well, there must be some better way of doing this.
Well, and it's so, it's kind of contrary to writing in a way.
It is.
I taught at Berkeley one time and then again at Montana for a short time, and I loved it. And I got really caught up in it and really spent myself each day I did it, and I certainly didn't want to go home and write.
Yes.
The last thing I wanted to do.
Right.
And it really turned, I thought, was a sort of an either or. You either do this or.
Plus, you have to read really bad stuff and treat it like Chekhov.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things I want to remind people is.
You need to accept bribes. That's what I would do.
Except, don't listen to those things. Those are bad. Start passing your questions over. The ushers will be moving down pretty quickly, and we'll collect those. One of the things you're leading into here, and Jim sort of broached this topic with me a couple times. Tom, you talked about it. Richard, you have a little different opinion. But it's that whole academia and sort of the industrialization of the MFA programs. And all three of you, as you mentioned, flirted with academia, and you answered that question. You didn't want to be a teacher. But do you think that industrialization of academia is going on with writing And also, Jim, as you mentioned, that the MFA should come with a product warning label.
Well, no, it's the whole point. There's a sad thing. That's the whole revolution of rising expectations. It seems to me very sad that you're turning out thousands of MFAs every year, which is a form of industrialization. But the fact of the matter is there's nothing you can do for a living more virulently and undemocratic than the arts. There's just not room for many people that can ever do well at it, you know? So this is the disappointment built into an MFA seems to be preposterous. And when I appeared at Iowa, I looked at these University of Iowa's writer's school. I said, why get me? You know I'm the enemy. And I'm looking at these 50 eager faces in this one class, not interested in anything except how can I get published, you know.
Exactly what you and I used to say when we were there.
Yeah, well, right. But we weren't in the college learning how to write, being taught how to do it. And it seems to me a spectacular failure is the 25,000 environmental majors we have now. It's really not fair to teach kids to
think. How about rock studies? That was a
rock studies. That
might imagine be. Applying down at the Ford Rouge plant with your
for rock.
Your
I want to be a rock star.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just the woundiness.
I think they're kind of good. I respectfully disagree with Jim. I think they're perfectly all right. First of all, some wonderful writers from Flannery O'Connor. Flannery O'Connor was an Iowa grad.
But if you think of why does it seem so limited to the Stegner program in Iowa?
Well,
if you think it's preposterous.
Oh, no, they're all over
successes.
The place now.
Yeah, I know they're all over, but the preposterous successes came from that. Oh. Don't touch me, Stegner program that you were involved in.
Richard was in that great one at SC, right?
Irvine. Yeah.
Where?
At Irvine. Yeah. I would have never gotten off the ground if I hadn't had Galway Connell as a teacher.
Who?
Galway Connell and E.L.
Well,
Doctorow as a teacher.
There, that depends on the talent. Yeah.
I don't know.
I just.
You know, I mean, I think what happens in a way is let's say you finish Michigan State with your bachelor's degree, and you have literary ambitions and not enough learning or not enough practice, anything that keeps you from being pitched into reality too soon buys you some treading water time.
I designed a program for MFA. See what you think about it very quickly. You meet up at the university for about a week. You talk about it. I pass out my list of the 180 essential authors since 1850. Then you work a year in a city, right, in an urban environment while you're reading. Then you work a week in a rural environment, you know. Hands-on.
This is going to be an uphill sail.
Yeah, okay. Then you come back to the university, and then maybe something experiential has happened to you other than just fucking going to college and walking in Morrill Hall in a state of torpor. Please, God. Can I go to Max Barr?
I want to remind you that you spent 6 years on your M.A., Jack.
No. I flunked out of graduate school at Michigan State.
Well, we all flunked out of everything that was put before us.
Yeah, that's true. I flunked out for reasons of arrogance, I was told.
My first term in college, I had set a kind of a record. I had a .6 average, and it was a baffling grade to me. I get back to the dorm, and there was a sign that said home, and I went down to the resident advisor. I said, "There's a sign in my door, sir. It says home. What does that mean?" It says it means go home. So I had a look at my grades, and there were two D's, a C, and an FN. And I knew what a D was. I'd had them before. I knew C's where I'd had them before, but I'd never seen an FN before. So I went around to see the logic teacher who had given it to me. And he said through his teeth, "I made that up for you, Mr. McGuane. It stands for flagrant neglect."
This all means if you want to be a writer, don't expect too much perfection from yourself early on. You will have many divorces, many addictions. Well, you will wander into the night, blah, blah, blah.
Well, I think the sad fact, of it, at least in an academic setting, is that people like the three of us, all joking aside, we you know, live and breathe writing. It's like Red Smith said, writing's easy. All you do is open up a vein and bleed. You're so bent on that you're kind of not very good at anything else. You're not so great at relationships for much of your life. You're not so great at going to college. You're not so great at holding jobs.
Or finances. Yeah.
Or finances, because what you care about is writing, and you really care about it in a kind of zealous way, and it's a monkey on your back that probably never goes away.
It doesn't make a good, it doesn't really make a good human being out of it. I really don't.
Ford cuts to the chase.
You're willing to say anything and pretend it's true. Yeah. I mean, it makes, I think, being married to a writer in that way must be one of the hardest things in the world for a person to do, because we're willing, for the most part, to say anything sometimes, just to kind of see, just to sort of see how it sounds. And if someone says, "Yes, I believe that," then you think, "Well, then it must be true."
What's that old saying? A lie repeated three times
is
the truth.
It's the truth.
Next year on the same stage, we're going to have all your spouses here. We're going to get the other other half.
You don't want that.
It would really cost you a lot of money.
In the end, we'll get it.
You just met your
my wife
spouses.
Is a taciturn Cornish person. And they don't,
not all your
they
spouses.
Don't talk about
it. Yeah, terrible.
Everything about modern culture to her is unspeakably filthy if it doesn't involve guards.
Yeah. Michael Keaton said to me not long ago, he said, "I've got a great job. I dress up and pretend to be other people and demand money for it." Made me think writing was kind of clean cut stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's what Graham Greene said writing was. Writing was you pretending to be someone else.
Yeah. There's a lot of that.
Yeah.
And they're so sensitive. I was over at Tom's and Michael Keaton was there with a young woman. They said, "Oh, Michael, so grand to meet your granddaughter," just as a joke.
And he was very awkward.
He didn't think it was funny.
I had another awkward moment with Keaton. I had this old friend who's kind of a financier. And he came into the house. He said, "Danny, I want you to meet Michael Keaton." And Michael, "This is Dan Lufkin." It's on. So Lufkin, who's he's just totally into finance. He doesn't know anything about what's really happening in the world. He gets back in the distance. He goes, McGuane, get over here. He backs into our laundry room, and he said, "That can't be Buster Keaton. Buster Keaton."
He did.
I like that. It's like my little daughter said to me, I come back from Hollywood from one of these profitable but dreary screenwriter stints, and she says, "Dad, tell me somebody famous actor you know." And I said, "Well, you know, I know Nicholson and Marlon Brando and Sean Connery." And she said, "Never heard of them." Left the room. So there's Dad. Devalued again.
I want to tell my little movie star story. We were making Missouri Breaks, and I was staying with Marlon Brando, and I went, and he was obsessed with American Indians, and he wanted to be in the movie, but he wanted to wear this great buckskin coat that he had, and he had a pet wolf that he wanted to be in the movie. So I went back to Montana, and I went out to the set, and I saw Patty Norris, who was one of these tough old kind of costume gals from old Hollywood. And I said, she said, what's your friend Brando up to? And I said, well, you know, he's ready to come up here and start shooting. But he's got this big, she was going to costume. He's insisting on wearing this buckskin coat he has. It's got fringe and beads. It's all buckskin, and it goes all the way down to the knee. And she said, she smokes her cigarette. And she said, I tell you what, she said, you tell your friend Marlon Brando, we're in Montana. And anything that weighs 300 pounds and is covered with white buckskin, they throw on the ground and brand. True.
But he had his way.
He had his way, and
he also wore a dress.
Yeah, I know. We lost control of him completely. But, you know, he couldn't really read his lines, so he'd staple them to things, you know. And he was driving Nicholson crazy because Nicholson wanted to have a mano-a-mano clash with him, and Brando kept sort of slipping away. So at one point, Nicholson comes up, and Brando's in a bathtub. This is my favorite moment.
Yeah, it's a great moment in the movie.
And he says, you ain't nothing. I'm not looking at anything. I think I'll shoot you or whatever. Brando just kind of rolls over, looks kind of bored. And as he rolls over, close film buffs will notice that the words Fruit of the Loom rise slowly out of the suds and disappear again. And if you see that, all the impact of the scene is lost.
I understood that part of this humanities thing. I was amused because Tom and I used to have a game about the Nick Adams stories, how the trickle down into the American sporting community gets a little weird. So we were always trying to create, and I continued to do, the man, the dog, the old man, the big swamp, the 10-point buck, the 10-point brown, the 12-foot wingspread. And then I added a thing I was pitching to a magazine, and then Hemingway's favorite, which was the girl with the 4-foot leg spread. They rang back and said, no. it was a toss-in.
Richard, you're going to have some movie television stories soon, aren't you? Isn't HBO going to start filming?
Well, they were until about a week ago. They were until they decided that there was a freeze on HBO series production until the end of the year. I don't know if it's a dead duck or not. It might be. Fortunately, I hadn't spent any of the money yet. So,
good move. You're going to have to do some writing.
No. I learned my lesson from my friends here. I don't do that. Yeah. I learned long ago that I'm no good at it. And as they know, you can spend an awful lot of time doing it. And a lot of times a lot of money does not come to you as a result. And really, I don't know if you all feel the same way or not, but I think that there's only one reason to work in the movies, and that's for a lot of money.
Absolutely.
And there's no other reason in the world.
But I have to follow you on this. You said you were no good at it.
I wasn't very good.
Well, that doesn't matter.
I know.
Why focus on something that doesn't bear on the case?
True. No,
we aren't any good at it either.
No, they spent several $1 million teaching me how to write screenplays, and I wasn't really interested. They keep talking to me, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
We can't show what a man is thinking about. You have to sort of
you have to make them say it, and if you make them say it, the lines that play very nicely on the page of your prose do not play very nicely at all when they're coming out of some poor guy's mouth.
No, and when you learned you could write, if you had enough cocaine and whiskey, you could write a screenplay in 12 days.
Yeah.
But it wasn't very good. You know?
Yep. And then you had the big drug bill.
Yes. Or you had the marriage bill or some kind of bill.
Well, there is no marriage at that point.
The health bill.
There's only the script.
Yeah, the marriage goes.
Well, here's something I borrowed from Sundog. The would-be writer in that says, unfortunately, in the gunny sack holding all the possible attitudes on earth, the most offensive is that of moral superiority. I've noticed, I think, in all your writing, you don't preach to people. You tell the story. You've chronicled the real working class, the unemployed, the schemers, the dreamers, the crooks. It's kind of a refreshing way of doing literature.
It probably has something to do with all of us believing something that I know is true, that drama is interesting when the villain says something that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And when you're willing to give the villains in your story, and God knows there are lots of, it's easy to write about them, when you're willing to give them equal time, when True. You're willing to give the bad guys good lines, well, then you begin to have a kind of a democracy in a
true,
sense.
True. And God's hitmen are swarming through our culture right now. They'll simply drive you
Why
crazy.
Did we forego preaching when preachers are doing so very well?
Oh, they're doing
What are literary fiction writers doing as compared to mega churches?
No, I once said around a couple.
Let's start telling people what to think and what to do.
Because we feel ourselves implicated in everything, I'm sure. And then I think the people who are doing all the preaching don't feel themselves implicated in anything.
No, I once said around a couple ICM agents, I think the real money is, this is in Hollywood, the real money is starting a new religion, and both of them called me the next morning about, hey, do you have anything in mind? I said only that I've changed my name to Baba Ram Jimmy.
I'm going to ask, because I can't really see behind me, how our questions are coming. I'd like to get those pretty quickly. I also want to remind everyone on the...
Here they are.
A little bird comes down.
Oh, George Fenneman.
Nothing sexual.
No, yeah. Tom doesn't like to answer sexual questions. The actresses in my life.
Okay.
Actress questions.
What or which is your favorite piece of literature? That sort of, we've talked a little bit about it, but is there any that just...
In my case, I'm not a person who plays favorites. I mean, one of the great things about being a writer and being as we all were before we were writers as readers, is that literature doesn't have to be best. All literature really has to be is excellent.
It's not a sacrilege, yeah.
You don't have to choose one piece of literature because you have this great munificence of books and you may have some that are closer to your heart than others, but even often it's the case that books that are not so close to your heart come back up in your thinking and then you realize how much you liked them years ago. So the whole notion to choose one thing and then not choose others is to me not instinctual with me.
Well, I would agree with Richard. I have lots of favorite books, but one that kind of looms a little bit for me for some reason or another is Don Quixote. I think I had a kind of an experience a little bit like the one Nabokov had with it, which was sort of misunderstanding it the first time, which I read it here at Michigan State. And then every time I kind of reread it, I find another level in it. But I have lots of favorite books. But I loved that, and I loved Gogol's Dead Souls, and I loved Machado de Assis's Epitaph for a Small Winter, and I loved Italo Svevo's As a Man Grows Older, and The Confessions of Zeno really bowled me over. But I think when Richard, and I think Jim will agree with this too, because I know he doesn't want to do the either-or sort of thing. I think when you don't play favorites and you always have a kind of state of expectation that there might be something phenomenal out there that will disturb your view of literature, that's part of the excitement of being a reader. And as Updike said, reading should be the best part of your life.
Right.
And it has been for me. I think I became a writer to justify my love of reading, and that's probably a greater force for me than the need
me
to
too.
Write.
I would have never been a writer if I hadn't been a reader, and I'm dyslexic, so I'm really slow. But I thought to myself, Christ, if I could write something that would have the effect on me that something like the end of Guests of the Nation, for instance, and anything that happened to me afterwards, I never felt the same about again. I just felt my heart just sort of suddenly double in size, and I thought, God, it would be wonderful to be able to do that. That's why I thought it was a good idea to try to write a story.
I think the books that really mean the most to you are the ones that you finish feeling that you have somehow been improved or enlarged.
Yes.
You know, Your heart is bigger. Your capacity for compassion is
also greater. It's a time function from year to year. Your sort of favorite books seem to evaporate and re-enter and re-enter and evaporate. So it depends on your...
I remember reading them. I used to go down by the Red Cedar River and every year that I was here and reread Walden and watch the condoms bob by and try to kind of get them kind of in the same plane of reference. And
no, I'm right.
And you know, I'm I did.
Sort of a different look at Walden.
Real success.
I'm writing a little book called Pilgrimages because I started visiting sort of strange graves like Rene Char or Machado and Couillard. You know, he walked across the border into from Spain, chased by Franco's people, not carrying his mom, so he abandoned his valise of poems the last 4 years of his life in order to carry his mom over in these 4 years of poems. Arguably the best 20th century Spanish poet. We're forever lost. Okay. But then I think this book of pilgrimages to certain writers, which I keep fooling with, is not about the best writers in my life, but the ones that affected me the most. Right. You know, when we were both reading Lagerbist, or, you know, and it goes on. Certain writers get you at certain points, and then...
Well, the other thing, too, is there's something kind of consoling when you read, say, Tolstoy or somebody from a completely different culture and time than your own, to find that you really are like them in some way, that we feel the same way about things. And you start feeling less abandoned as a member of the human family, and you don't you're not as terrified of mortality because there's something about our collective reality that we get reassured about by great literature,
which is an issue when people are editing you, because if you're being edited by these very scrupulous magazines, sometimes quite young editors will say, "Well, I think our readers will have a little bit of trouble with that." And I think, well, shit. You know? And every one of us, you know, slaved when we were kids through books that we were having trouble with.
Yeah, right.
And I always say, well, good. Yeah. Let them have trouble.
Yeah, behind one spring behind the library, Michigan State Library, where I worked on my break time, I was reading over and over again. Due to mental instability, I was reading over and over again Finnegan's Wake down by the Red Cedar. You know, the same. And I just loved this book because it was as berserk language-wise as my life. So I found this is the most comforting thing I could read at the time was Finnegan's Wake. You know, so now I find it a little difficult. But at the time, it was...
Different time, different place. I know a lot of the audience, even though there's been a lot of media coverage where you've answered this question, but why did you come to MSU, Richard?
Because, well, for a lot of different reasons. One was to get out of the South. It just was to get away as far away as I could from Jackson, Mississippi, because I was on the wrong side of the race issues down there, and I was already having problems. And I was not at all a forward-thinking person. Just by instinct, I just wasn't doing things quite right. And then my grandfather was in the hotel business, and he said to me, "You know, I had no idea of a job or a future or anything, because my father was dead, and I didn't care." And he said, "You know, you're going to have to do something somehow." And he said, "Why don't you go and get a degree in hotel, restaurant, and institutional management? And I'll bring you back to Little Rock, and you can work in the hotel." So I came up here to study hotel science. And I lasted, and I remember very well, I was in the middle of the first term and doing very poorly. And I saw that ahead of me was a curriculum. And there was a course in the second term that had to do with
it was called instrumentation, I think it was called, and it had to do with identifying mops. And I thought, that isn't a liberal education. I thought, I can do that on my own. And so... So, I mean, I did one of those things that you do when you have a crisis and you're young and you're someplace by yourself. I went over to the counseling center. And I said, I'm not doing well in hotel institutional management. And they said, well, take this test.
That ever happened.
And I took the test and they said, well, you should be an English major.
Yeah.
And I said, well, okay, then I'll be an English.
Yeah. The money factory.
Yeah, I thought, yes. High five.
Well, the rest is history. Thank you. That's great.
I was a transfer student from Olivet, and I was very happy at Olivet. It was a school that I revered then and do now. It was a wonderful little ancient small Michigan college, and but I thought I could make the soccer team if they had a soccer team. They didn't. So I transferred to Michigan and Michigan State and tried out for the soccer team, and I remember I suited up and went down there, and
I only heard the Spanish language, and that was my first bad sign. And it was that feeling of being whitey all over again. You know? I just didn't like the feeling. So anyway, I struggled along. It was clear that I was not going to be a starting soccer player. So there I was, it seemed to be such a huge school, and. And when my soccer dream evaporated, I had no idea why I was here.
Well, mine, I had a sort of full ride offered to me about Kalamazoo College, which we all know is very good, but I went over there and it looked like sort of a green-covered hill or something. And I felt... They seemed bright people, but I felt utterly confined, and I knew there, if I had gone there, I'd be under scrutiny.
Harrison has always hated conventional views of the natural world. He said he had been working for a bookseller in New England. He said, I never go through New England in autumn without holding my nose.
But it was the idea. I wanted to go to a bigger place where people wouldn't be all the time giving you a hard time. And that was Michigan State. You were invincible.
We're gonna wrap this up. I'm gonna ask each of you a question, and then we could talk all night. But I know we have to get on to the second half where you guys can
wait to the second.
Second half is where you can keep five books, and then to make money.
Did a reading in Washington, D.C., and only one person came. He came, I'm going to do this reading. And the guy had two gigantic shopping bags. This is how he spot book collection. And so the guy sat there with the two big shopping bags. Walter Drew read a story. And when he got done with the story, the guy picked up the bags and left. He was just a homeless guy.
Philip Roth had an awful year. It puts good luck
only a fool let good luck put pressure on you. I mean, it's just
crazy. Although we had an old scientific saying in our Irish family, which was, it's better to be lucky than to rise early.
Not smart enough for it to really have a dawning effect on me. I just thought, well, it's a really nice day, made my wife happy, and then kind of life went back to normal. But I was thinking,
you would think the Nobel would be better because it's $1 million.
You all be bad something when you get the Nobel Prize, you get $2,000 all at once. It'd probably work more.
Yeah.
Tom, several people want to know your experiences with the Red Cedar Review and then its predecessor, Thoreau.
What was the predecessor? It was called Thoreau.
Yeah.
Thoreau.
So what? They want to know what you felt about it, what it was like to start it. Well, what it was like in the first edition of it to have your story lead off.
The one thing I remember is Thoreau had a small office with a tremendous closet. And there were, in those days, those puritanical days, there were very few places where you could meet girls privately.
My fifth one, which will be my big book of novels, because he was stranded in Canada and they had to get him back to America, which is difficult. But it was a success. And now they're in Canada going to bring out top five Ground Dogs in a single volume, and I said, why? Am I doubting any publishing market? Well, Sarah McLachlan said, Canada, we have more brown dogs than you do. Why not bring it out here? We have more than you. So I can't let it go. I thought, I'm going to terminate it with this shift because I don't live in the UP anymore. And then I thought, well, maybe I'd be lost if I hate that word closure anyway, you know, I always ask.
Especially at our age.
So I just finished the fifth, and he's Hale and Hardy, you know. As Deborah Schwartz said in Escanaba, this is the only man in the world that gets a hard on when I'm pulling his tooth.